It's a good thing Bill Clinton has an iron stomach. His ability to eat anything put in front of him is one of his many political talents. I do not share his intestinal fortitude, and Yeltsin knew it. He loved to tease me. And this was one moment when I was glad that a sow has only two ears. Years later, toward the end of Yeltsin's and Bill's terms in office, we had one final dinner together in the Kremlin. Toward the middle of the meal, Yeltsin said to me, in a rumbling, conspiratorial voice, "Hillary, I will miss seeing you. I have a picture of you in my office. I look at it every day." There was a mischievous gleam in his eye. "Well, thank you, Boris," I said. "I hope we will still see each other from time to time." "Yes, you must come to see me. You must promise to see me." "I hope I'll get to see you, Boris." "Good," he said. "Now, Hillary, I have a very special treat for you tonight."
"What is it?"
"I'm not going to tell you. You must wait until it comes." We sat through course after course and toast after toast. And finally, just before dessert, a waiter set bowls of hot soup in front of us. "This is it, Hillary, your special treat," said Boris, grinning as he sniffed the pungent steam. "Mmm, delicious." "What is it?" I asked as I picked up my spoon. He paused dramatically. "Moose lips." Sure enough, floating in the murky broth was my own set of moose lips. The gelatinous shapes looked like rubber bands that had lost their stretch, and I pushed them around the bowl until the waiter took them away. I've tasted a lot of unusual food from my country, but I drew the line at moose lips. The Denver meeting was a success, but building good relations with the Russians was a long-term project that carried over to the NATO summit in Madrid in July. Bill and I traveled to Europe a few days ahead of the conference for a visit to the Mediterranean island of Majorca as guests of King Juan Carlos I and Queen Sofia of Spain. Once there, we met up with Chelsea. We continued on to Madrid for the summit of NATO members. After our official duties were over, Queen Sofia and King Juan Carlos took Bill, Chelsea, and me to the Alhambra Palace in Granada. When Bill and I had first started dating, he told me that the most beautiful natural sight he had ever seen was the sun setting over the Grand Canyon, and the most beautiful man-made one was the Alhambra Palace, lit by the rays of the setting sun as it sank over the plains of Granada. When I shared the story with the king, he insisted that I must see it for myself. We toured the castle and then ate dinner at a restaurant in a centuries-old house with a stunning view of the palace. We watched the sun go down, painting the walls a rusty pink. As we lingered into the night, we saw the palace's own lights come up, equally stunning. After such an evening, I felt I could levitate myself to my next destination, Vienna, where I was keynote speaker at a forum entitled Vital Voices, Women in Democracy. Conceived and organized by Swanee Hunt, our ambassador to Austria, and nurtured by Milan Verveer, this meeting was an outgrowth of Beijing and brought together representatives of our government, NGOs, and international corporations to promote progress for women in three areas: building democracy, strengthening economies, and working to achieve peace. I thought personal attention to political and individual development was missing in our own diplomatic rhetoric about democracy and free markets. Women and children suffered disproportionately during the difficult transition from communism to capitalism and democracy because they no longer could rely on fixed incomes common to centralized economies or on free education and health care provided by the state. Vital Voices continues to encourage women's entrepreneurship in places as diverse as South Africa and the Baltic states. It supports efforts to involve women in the political sphere in Kuwait and Northern Ireland, and it galvanizes women to combat trafficking of women and children in Ukraine and Russia. Our hectic schedule finally slowed down enough for us to return to Martha's Vineyard in August for summer vacation. I preferred reading and swimming in the surf while Bill perfected his swing with Vernon Jordan and his other golfing buddies. Bill and I were attending an evening beach party when a staff member murmured something in his ear. I watched from a distance and saw the shock register on Bill's face. Then I heard the news, too. Princess Diana had been in a terrible car crash in Paris. Like everyone else in the world, we were shocked. I had last seen Diana 2 months earlier. We'd met at the White House, where she talked passionately and intelligently about two of her chief causes, banning landmines and educating people about HIV/AIDS. She told me that she hoped her boys might study in America someday, and I offered to be a resource for her and for them. She was clearly looking forward to the future, which made her death all the more tragic. Early the next morning, I received a call from a representative of Diana's family, asking if I would attend the funeral in London. The day before Diana's funeral, the world lost another of its most compelling personalities when Mother Teresa died in Calcutta. I flew back to Martha's Vineyard from Diana's funeral, then turned around to fly to Calcutta for Mother Teresa's. Mother Teresa's open casket was carried through the crowded streets of Calcutta into an indoor arena packed with people. The service went on for hours because the leaders of each national and religious delegation were called one at a time to lay a wreath of white flowers on the funeral bier. I had lots of time to reflect on my brief but enriching relationship with Mother Teresa. We first met in February 1994 at the National Prayer Breakfast in a Washington hotel ballroom. She had just delivered a speech against abortion, and she wanted to talk to me. Mother Teresa was unerringly direct. She disagreed with my views on a woman's right to choose, and she told me so. I had the greatest respect for her opposition to abortion, but I believe that it is dangerous to give any state the power to enforce criminal penalties against women and doctors. I consider that a slippery slope to state control of reproduction, and I'd witnessed the consequences of such control in China and communist Romania. While we never agreed about abortion and birth control, Mother Teresa and I found much common ground in many other areas, including the importance of adoption. We shared the conviction that adoption was a vastly better choice than abortion for unplanned or unwanted babies. The extent of her influence was in full display at the arena in Calcutta as presidents and prime ministers knelt before her open casket. Mother Teresa left a powerful legacy and a well-equipped successor in Sister Nirmala, a fellow missionary of charity who had worked with Mother Teresa for years. After the memorial service, Sister Nirmala invited me to visit their Calcutta orphanage and asked me to a private meeting at the Mother House, headquarters of their order. When I arrived, Sister Nirmala led me into a simple whitewashed room, lit only by tiers of flickering devotional candles arranged against the walls. When my eyes adjusted, I saw that Mother Teresa's closed casket had been brought here to her home, where she would remain forever. The nuns formed a circle around the coffin and stood in quiet prayer. Then Sister Nirmala asked me to offer a prayer. I was taken aback and hesitated, feeling inadequate to the occasion. Then I bowed my head and thanked God for the privilege of having known this tiny, forceful, saintly woman during her time here on earth. I had no doubt she would be watching from heaven as each of us in our own way tried to fulfill her admonition to love God and one another. By mid-September, the occasion I had dreaded for years finally arrived. Chelsea was moving to California to start her freshman year at Stanford. Our hope was that Chelsea's arrival on campus in mid-September 1997 would be as low-key as possible. Although she would have 24-hour protection, the young agents assigned to her detail would look and dress like students, and they would quietly set up residence in a dorm room near Chelsea's. Chelsea, Bill, and I arrived in Palo Alto on a gorgeous autumn day. We made our way to a three-story concrete dormitory that would be Chelsea's home away from home. The last-minute shopping and packing had left me exhausted, and as is typical of many mothers, I went into overdrive as soon as we got inside the dorm. Chelsea's room, which she shared with another young woman, was barely big enough to accommodate bunk beds, two desks, and a couple of dressers. I was on a mission, rushing around in a vain attempt to organize Chelsea's belongings. Bill, meanwhile, resembled most of the other fathers, who seemed to go into a slow-motion trance the moment they set foot on campus. Bill had insisted on carrying Chelsea's luggage himself, and then armed with a minuscule wrench, he tackled the bunk bed, which Chelsea and her roommate wanted to take apart. After deducing that the bunk first needed to be turned upside down, Bill completed the task and then retreated to the window where he stood and stared out morosely, looking like a dazed boxer who had just been pummeled in the ring. By late afternoon, it was time for all the parents to leave. freeing the students to arrange and rearrange their possessions without parental interference. Most of the other mothers and I gathered up our belongings, including unused contact paper, and began to make our way to the exits. After weeks of planning, shopping, packing, unpacking, and organizing, we had steeled ourselves for this moment. Watching the fathers, however, I realized that they had no such preparation. Just as it was time to leave, they seemed to awaken from their collective fog, suddenly anxious over the prospect of parting from their offspring. "What do you mean it's time to leave?" Bill said. "Do we really have to go now?" He looked bereft. "Can't we come back after dinner?" I visited Chequers, the official country residence of Britain's Prime Minister, in late 1997, invited by Prime Minister and Mrs. Blair to a small meeting of American and British political thinkers. Tony Blair had been elected 6 months earlier on a platform of progressive ideas that refashioned traditional Labour Party thinking about social and economic issues. In the aftermath of his election, he had credited Bill for inspiring him and his party to chart a different direction as the United Kingdom and Europe confronted the challenges of globalization and economic and political security. Whether you call it New Democrats, New Labour, the Third Way, or the Vital Center, Tony Blair and Bill Clinton clearly shared a political vision. But the question confronting each of them was how to invigorate a progressive movement that had lost steam through much of the 1970s and 80s, giving rise to Reaganism in the United States and Thatcherism in Britain. After his election as Prime Minister in May 1997, Blair invited Bill to London for an official visit. When Cherie and Tony Blair and Bill and I met over a long dinner at a restaurant near the Tower of London on the Thames River, the conversation never stalled. We shared ideas about problems in education and welfare, and our concerns about the pervasive influence of media. Over the course of dinner, we decided to initiate a discussion among our advisors to explore common ideas and strategies. Organizing the first meeting took months because of resistance from officials in each of our countries. The National Security Council and the British Foreign Office worried that we would offend other friendly nations and governments by holding meetings that included only the United States and Britain. In order to limit attention, Bill would not attend the first meeting that Tony wanted to host at Chequers. Chequers sits on 1,000 acres of rolling English countryside, its grounds lined with stone paths and manicured gardens. Tony met me at the door wearing blue jeans and his trademark boyish grin. That evening, the Blairs, Milan, and I enjoyed a private dinner and stayed up late into the night, sitting in front of a large stone fireplace in the Great Hall. We talked about a broad array of subjects, ranging from Yeltsin and his inner circle to French perfidy vis-a-vis Iran and Iraq to U.S. involvement in Bosnia. We also discussed what Tony called the cellular fatigue that seems to come with public life these days, and the connection between our religious faith and public service. The next morning, the other American and British participants arrived. Over coffee in the great parlor on the second floor, we discussed policies that could support families in their primary functions of raising children, as well as education and employment policies. As soon as I got back to the United States, I briefed Bill and recommended that he continue the Third Way meetings, which he did, including other like-minded leaders. These Third Way meetings introduced a new way for the administration to work with America's traditional allies. I turned 50 in October, and though the rule books say that this is a difficult passage, it felt insignificant compared to living without Chelsea. I thought our nest needed refilling. It was time to get a dog. We hadn't had a canine companion since our Cocker Spaniel Zeke died in 1990. Shortly after we buried Zeke, Chelsea brought home a black and white kitten she named Sox, who moved with us to the White House, where he clearly preferred to be an only cat. But after Bill was elected to a second term and we knew Chelsea would be leaving for college, we started thinking about getting another dog. Chelsea wanted a teeny tiny dog she could carry around with her, and Bill wanted a big dog he could run with. We worked through that and finally decided that a Labrador would be just the right size and temperament for our family and the White House. In early December, a bouncing 3-month-old chocolate lab met the president for the first time. The puppy scampered straight into Bill's arms and they fell in love on the spot. All we had to do was figure out a name for the dog. People wrote letters with suggestions and devised dog naming contests. Two of my favorite candidates were Arkin Paws and Clinton Tin. The process was getting out of hand, and we realized we'd better hurry up and name the poor little thing. We finally decided on a simple and, to our minds, noble name, Buddy. Buddy was the nickname of my husband's favorite uncle, Orrin Grisham, a devoted dog owner and trainer who had died the previous spring. The more Bill talked about the new puppy, the more he remembered his Uncle Buddy, and the clearer it became that we should name the dog after him. The little lab settled swiftly into my husband's routine. He slept by his feet in the Oval Office, and he stayed up late into the night. Buddy quickly became the center of our family life, which was hard for Sox to deal with. If we left them in the same room, we inevitably came back to find Sox with his back arched, hissing at Buddy, who was intent on chasing the cat under the couch. Both of them had their fans, and each received thousands of letters, mostly from children who expressed their affection and preference for one or the other. In 1998, I published some of the letters in Dear Sox, Dear Buddy, giving the proceeds to the National Park Foundation. Before we knew it, Christmas had come and gone, and we were off for our trip to Hilton Head, South Carolina, for Renaissance Weekend and a gathering of 1,500 friends and acquaintances. Then Bill, Chelsea, and I went to St. Thomas for a vacation all by ourselves. We did what we usually do. We played cards and word games and put together a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. One afternoon, Bill and I put on our bathing suits and ventured down to the beach for a swim. Unbeknownst to us, a photographer from a wire service was hiding in the bushes on a public beach across the bay. He must have had a powerful telephoto lens, because the next day a photo of us slow dancing on the beach appeared in newspapers around the world. Obviously, the incident raised questions about security as well as privacy. If you're close enough to take a picture with a telephoto lens, you're close enough to shoot a gun with a scope. Bill wasn't upset. He liked the photo. Some journalists even speculated that we had posed for the photo in hopes that our embrace would be captured on film. Hello! As I told a radio interviewer a few weeks later, just name me any 50-year-old woman who would knowingly pose in her bathing suit with her back pointed toward the camera. Well, maybe people who look good from any angle, like Cher or Jane Fonda or Tina Turner, but not me. In January 1998, Kenneth Starr's inquiry was in its fourth year. The previous fall, Starr had finally conceded that Vince Foster really had committed suicide. Starr had also run into a dead end in his original probe of the Whitewater land deal. The most active litigation we were contending with was a civil case unrelated to the Office of the Independent Counsel investigation. Paula Jones's legal team was being paid for and guided by the Rutherford Institute, a legal aid organization with a fundamentalist right-wing agenda. The Supreme Court had decided to let the case proceed. Jones, therefore, was entitled to depose witnesses, including the president. Bill was scheduled to be interviewed under oath on Saturday, January 17, 1998. Although there had been opportunities to settle with Jones out of court, I had opposed the idea in principle, believing that it would set a terrible precedent for any president to pay money to rid himself of a nuisance suit. With the wisdom of hindsight, of course, not settling the Jones suit was the second biggest tactical mistake we made in handling the barrage of investigations and lawsuits. The first was requesting an independent counsel at all. Bill had been up late the night before, preparing for his testimony. I waited for him in the residence, and when he came back, he looked agitated and exhausted. I asked him how he thought it went, and he told me it was a farce and that he resented the whole process. Then on Wednesday morning, January 21st, Bill woke me up early. He sat on the edge of the bed and said, "There's something in today's papers you should know about." "What are you talking about?" I asked. He told me there were news reports that he'd had an affair with a former White House intern and that he had asked her to lie about it to Paula Jones's lawyers. Starr requested and obtained permission from Attorney General Janet Reno to expand his investigation to look into possible criminal charges against the president. Bill told me that Monica Lewinsky was an intern he had befriended 2 years earlier when she was volunteering in the West Wing during the government shutdown. He had talked to her a few times, and she had asked him for some job hunting help. This was completely in character for Bill. He said that she had misinterpreted his attention, which was something I had seen happen dozens of times before. I questioned Bill over and over about the story. He continued to deny any improper behavior, but to acknowledge that his attention could have been misread. I will never truly understand what was going through my husband's mind that day. All I know is that Bill told his staff and our friends the same story he told me, that nothing improper went on. Why he felt he had to deceive me and others is his own story, and he needs to tell it in his own way. In a better world, this sort of conversation between a husband and a wife would be no one's business but our own. Though I had long tried to protect what was left of our privacy, I could do nothing now. For me, the Lewinsky imbroglio seemed just like another vicious scandal manufactured by political opponents. After all, since he had started running for public office, Bill had been accused of everything from drug running to fathering a child with a Little Rock prostitute. And I had been called a thief and a murderer. I expected that, ultimately, the intern story would be a footnote in tabloid history. I believed my husband when he told me there was no truth to the charges, but I realized that we faced the prospect of another horrible and invasive investigation. A nuisance civil action had metastasized into a criminal investigation by Starr, who would undoubtedly take it as far as he could. It appeared that the questions in the Jones deposition were designed solely to trap the president into charges of perjury, which might then justify a demand for his resignation or impeachment. This was a lot of bad news to absorb in one morning, but I knew that both Bill and I had to carry on with our daily routines. That afternoon, I was scheduled to give a speech on civil rights to a large gathering at Goucher College. I headed to Union Station and caught a train to Baltimore. David Kendall telephoned me during the train ride. According to him, the Office of the Independent Counsel was likely planning to subpoena every employee, friend, and family member who might have information about the Lewinsky matter. I chose to keep going and to fight back, but it wasn't pleasant to listen to what was being said about my husband. I knew that people were wondering, how can she get up in the morning, let alone go out in public? Even if she doesn't believe the charges, it has to be devastating just to hear them. Well, it was. Eleanor Roosevelt's observance that every woman in political life must develop skin as tough as rhinoceros hide had become a mantra for me as I faced one crisis after another. You don't just wake up one day and say, well, I'm not going to let anything bother me, no matter how vicious or mean-spirited. It was, for me, an isolating and lonely experience. I also worried that the armor I had acquired might distance me from my true emotions, that I might turn into the brittle caricature some critics accused me of being. I constantly examined myself for traces of denial or hardening of emotional arteries. I made my speech, then returned to the Baltimore train station, where a mob of reporters and camera crews was waiting for me. Someone shouted above the rest, "Do you think the charges are false?" I stopped and turned to the microphones. "Certainly I believe they are false. Absolutely," I said. "It's difficult and painful any time someone you care about, you love, you admire, is attacked and is subjected to such relentless accusations as my husband has been." "Why is Bill Clinton being attacked?" "There has been a concerted effort to undermine his legitimacy as president, to undo much of what he has been able to accomplish, to attack him personally when he could not be defeated politically." It was not the first time I had said this, nor would it be the last. Like me, Bill did not back out of any prior commitments. He went ahead with previously scheduled interviews for National Public Radio, Roll Call, and PBS Television. He discussed foreign policy and the upcoming State of the Union address scheduled for Tuesday, January 27th. Then he patiently responded to each question about his personal life with essentially the same answer. The allegations weren't true. He didn't ask anybody to lie. He would cooperate with the investigation, but it would be inappropriate to say more at this time. Washington was obsessed with the scandal to the point of hysteria. New facts were emerging daily about the mechanics of what was essentially a sting operation to entrap the president, including secret, illegal tape recordings. The next day was the State of the Union address, and I kept a long-scheduled commitment to go to New York to appear on the Today Show that morning. I would rather have had a root canal. But a cancellation would have created its own avalanche of speculation. So off I went, confident that I knew the truth, but dreading the prospect of discussing such matters on national television. Matt Lauer was hosting the show that morning without Katie Couric, whose husband had tragically lost his battle with colon cancer 3 days earlier. I took a seat across from Matt, and immediately following the 7 o'clock news, he began the interview. There has been one question on the minds of people in this country, Mrs. Clinton, lately, and that is, what is the exact nature of the relationship between your husband and Monica Lewinsky? Has he described the relationship in detail to you? I answered, well, we've talked at great length, and I think as this matter unfolds, the entire country will have more information. But we're right in the middle of a rather vigorous feeding frenzy right now, and people are saying all kinds of things and putting out rumor and innuendo. Lauer mentioned how our friend James Carville had described the situation as a war between the president and Kenneth Starr. Well, I said, I do believe that this is a battle. The great story here for anybody willing to find it and write about it and explain it is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president. Later, when David Kendall called to discuss my appearance, I told him I had thought about him as I was going into the interview. I heard your words of wisdom ringing in my ear, I said. And which words of incredible wisdom were you hearing, said David, going for the bait. Screw 'em, I laughed. David, who was raised as a Quaker, chuckled and said sheepishly, it's an old Quaker expression. Oh, like screw thee. We were both laughing hard now, letting off steam. Sure enough, the vast conspiracy line got Starr's attention. He took the unusual step of firing off a statement complaining that I had cast aspersions on his motives. As they say in Arkansas, it's the hit dog that howls. Meanwhile, there was speculation in the news about the State of the Union address that night. Would the president mention the scandal? He would not. Would members of Congress boycott the speech? Only a few did, although some Republicans sat on their hands all night. Would the First Lady show up to support her husband? You bet I did. Months earlier, I had accepted an invitation to speak at the annual World Economic Forum that takes place most years in Davos, Switzerland, a beautiful little ski village in the Alps. I was relieved that some of the American attendees at Davos were old friends, including Vernon Jordan and Mayor Richard Daley. Ellie and Marion Wiesel were particularly kind. His experience as a Holocaust survivor has given Ellie a kind of genius for empathy. He greeted me with a long hug and asked, what is wrong with America? Why are they doing this? I don't know, Ellie, I said. Well, I just want you to know that Marion and I are your friends, and we want to help you. Their understanding was the greatest gift they could give. My speech went well, despite the less than scintillating title the conference organizers suggested, Individual and Collective Priorities for the 21st Century. I described the three essential components of any modern society, an effective, functioning government, a free market economy, and a vibrant civil society. The morning after my speech, I seized the chance to hit the nearby slopes. I've never been a good skier, but I love the sport. It was wonderful to lose myself in sheer physical sensation, the cold, clear air rushing by as I glided down the mountain, wishing I could ski for hours, even with my Secret Service detail trailing behind me. For a few moments, I was delivered from gravity. On February 5, 1998, there was an official dinner in the White House in honor of Tony Blair. Given the friendship Bill and I had developed with Tony and Cherie, as well as the historic ties and special relationship between our nations, I wanted to pull out all the stops for the Blairs. And we did, with the largest dinner we ever hosted inside the White House. For the after-dinner entertainment, I lined up Sir Elton John and Stevie Wonder to perform together, truly a great Anglo-American musical alliance. When Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich accepted our invitation, I decided to seat him on my left, while Blair, as expected by protocol, would sit on my right. Gingrich admired Blair as a transformational political leader, a term he had once used to describe himself. At our dinner table, after a long discussion about NATO expansion, Bosnia, and Iraq, Gingrich leaned in my direction. "These accusations against your husband are ludicrous," he said. And I think it's terribly unfair the way some people are trying to make something out of it. Even if it were true, it's meaningless. It's not going anywhere. Gingrich completely changed his tune when he led the Republican charges for Bill's impeachment. For the moment, though, I took this conversation as evidence that Gingrich was more complicated and unpredictable than I had thought. Months later, when his own marital infidelities were exposed, I better understood why Gingrich may have wanted to dismiss this issue. In February, Starr decided to subpoena members of the Secret Service to compel them to testify before the grand jury. Starr was looking for something that would contradict Bill's deposition in the Jones case, and he wanted agents to report on conversations they might have overheard or activities they might have witnessed in the course of protecting the president. Lou Merletti, a Vietnam veteran who had led the Presidential Protective Division and then became the director of the Secret Service, met with Starr's operatives and warned them that forcing agents to testify would compromise the necessary trust between agents and presidents, undermining presidential safety now and in the future. But before the end of the year, Starr had forced more than 24 Secret Service agents to testify. By early spring of 1998, the public seemed to be tiring of Starr's investigation. The media began to pursue the possibility that there was some organized effort against us. On February 9th, Newsweek magazine published a 2-page chart entitled "Conspiracy or Coincidence?" It traced the connections linking 23 conservative politicians, contributors, media executives, authors, lawyers, organizations, and others who had fueled and funded the various scandals investigated by Starr. Then in the April issue of Esquire magazine, David Brock wrote an open letter to the president, apologizing for his Troopergate story, which had been published in the American Spectator in 1994 and which had led to the Paula Jones lawsuit. On April 1st, while Bill and I were overseas on the final leg of his presidential trip to Africa, Bob Bennett phoned with an important message for the president. Judge Susan Weber Wright had decided to throw out the Paula Jones lawsuit, finding that it lacked factual or legal merit. By mid-June, the judge supervising the Whitewater grand jury, Norma Holloway Johnson, ruled that there was probable cause to believe that the Office of the Independent Counsel was leaking information illegally and that David Kendall could subpoena Starr and his deputies to find the source of the leaks. Against this backdrop, Bill forged ahead with his agenda. Throughout the first half of 1998, he was battling with the Gang of Three, Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay, and Dick Armey, who were determined to kill the administration's budget for the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Arts and to sap federal support for cultural activities throughout the country. I championed public television and brought Big Bird and the other Sesame Street characters to the White House for a press conference. And thankfully, the puppets were saved. Bill had a new nominee for ambassador to the United Nations, Richard Holbrooke, whom Senate Republicans were in no mood to vote on. After 14 months, Holbrooke prevailed and went to the United Nations in August of 1999. The highlight of the spring was Bill's long-awaited trip to Africa. Since we had first met, Bill had opened my horizons to the world beyond our country, but now it was my turn to show him what I had discovered. We arrived in Accra, the capital of Ghana, on March 23, 1998, to a welcome by the largest crowd I'd ever seen. More than 500,000 people gathered in the searing heat in Independence Square to hear Bill speak. Standing on the stage and facing the immense crowd, he told me to look behind us at the rows of tribal kings who were decked out in vibrant robes and festooned with gold jewelry. He squeezed my hand. "We're a long way from Arkansas, little Hiri." Every day was an eye-opener for Bill. In Uganda, President and Mrs. Museveni traveled with us to a village near the source of the Nile. I had asked the two presidents to highlight the positive results of microcredit loans, and they had agreed and come with me to the village. From house to house, we saw the evidence of success. Borrowers who had used their loans to build a rabbit hutch, or to buy a bigger cooking pot to make extra food to sell, or to purchase goods to take to market. Bill wanted to go to Rwanda to meet with survivors of the genocide. For 2 hours, victim after victim calmly recited the circumstances of his or her encounter with evil. No country or international force, including the United States, had intervened to halt the killings. Bill publicly expressed regret that our country and the international community had not done more to stop the genocide. In Cape Town, Bill and I were greeted by President Mandela, who ushered Bill into a speech before the South African Parliament. We lunched afterwards with a racially diverse group of parliamentarians who, before independence, would never have met one another socially. Botswana, a landlocked arid nation, has the contrasting distinction of having one of the highest per capita incomes in sub-Saharan Africa and the highest AIDS infection rate in the world. This visit convinced Bill to push hard to triple U.S. funding for international AIDS programs in just 2 years. At our final stop in Senegal, Bill went to Gori Island, as I had. He saw the door of no return and delivered a moving apology for America's role in slavery. The statement was controversial among some Americans, but I thought it was very appropriate. Within a month, still talking and thinking about Africa, Bill and I were off to China for a state visit. I was delighted that we could take Chelsea and my mother along. I had met President Jiang Zemin in October of 1997 when he and his wife came to the United States for a state visit. Jiang spoke English and conversed easily. Before the visit, some of my friends had asked me to raise with him the issue of China's suppression of Tibet. So I asked him to explain China's repression of the Tibetans and their religion. "What do you mean?" he said. "Tibet has historically been a part of China. The Chinese are the liberators of the Tibetan people. I have read the histories in our libraries, and I know Tibetans are better off now than they were before." "But what about their traditions and the right to practice their religion as they choose?" He became passionate, even banging the table once. "They were victims of religion. They are now freed from feudalism." Despite a developing global culture, the same facts can be and often are viewed through different historical and cultural prisms, and the word freedom is defined to fit one's political perspective. Still, I don't think Zhang was being quite straight with me. The Chinese, for historical and psychological reasons, were obsessed with avoiding internal disintegration. In the case of Tibet, that led to overreaction and oppression, as obsessions often do. During our visit to China, Bill and I again raised our concerns about Tibet and the general state of human rights in China. Predictably, the Chinese leaders were adamant and dismissive. When I'm asked why a U.S. president should visit any country with whom we have such serious differences, my answer is always the same. America, the most diverse nation in human history, now wields unparalleled power. But we can be quite insular and uninformed about other countries and their perspectives. Our leaders and our people benefit from learning more about the world in which we live and compete and try to cooperate. The Chinese government surprised us by permitting the uncensored broadcast of the news conference Bill and Zhang held, during which they had an extended exchange on the subject of human rights, including Tibet. And then they broadcast Bill's address to students at Beijing University, in which he stressed that true freedom includes more than economic freedom. Bill, Chelsea, my mother, and I toured the Forbidden City and the Great Wall. We attended Sunday services at a state-sanctioned Protestant church, a rite forbidden to many, to demonstrate our public support for greater religious freedom in China. In Shanghai, intent on emphasizing religious freedom, Secretary Albright and I toured the newly restored Ohel Rachel Synagogue, one of several synagogues built by the large Jewish community that had flourished in the 19th and 20th centuries as Jews fled to Shanghai from Europe and Russia. As soon as we returned from China, I focused on our own cultural and artistic history, and a celebration of the millennium that I had been thinking about for months. Democracy requires large reservoirs of intellectual capital to continue the extraordinary enterprise of our nation's founders. Over the last several years, I had become concerned about a cavalier anti-intellectualism in our public discourse. Some members of Congress had proudly announced that they had never traveled outside of our country. I organized a series of White House lectures and performances in the East Room. Scholars, scientists, and artists explored issues from the cultural roots of American jazz to genetics to women's history. As part of our 2-year commemoration, I initiated Save America's Treasures, a new program to restore and recognize cultural and historic landmarks and artifacts around our country. In July, I embarked on a 4-day bus trip from Washington to Seneca Falls, New York, stopping along the way at places of significance: Baltimore's Fort McHenry, Thomas Edison's factory in New Jersey, George Washington's military headquarters in Newburgh, New York, a park in Victor, New York dedicated to Iroquois culture, and Harriet Tubman's house in Auburn, New York. Harriet Tubman is one of my heroines. A former slave, she escaped to freedom on the Underground Railroad and then courageously returned to the South time and time again to lead other slaves to freedom. "If you are tired, keep going," she said to the slaves she led on treacherous paths from slavery to freedom. "If you are scared, keep going. If you are hungry, keep going. If you want a taste of freedom, keep going." The emotional capstone of the tour was an event at the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls, attended by 16,000 people. This marked the 150th anniversary of the Campaign for Women's Suffrage, led by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Inspired by the history that this small town represented for women and for America, I open my remarks with the story of Charlotte Woodward, a 19-year-old glove maker living in nearby Waterloo 150 years ago. I asked the audience to imagine her life, working for low wages, knowing that if she married, her pay, her children, and even the clothes on her body would belong to her husband. Imagine Charlotte's curiosity and growing excitement on July 19, 1848, when she traveled by horse-drawn carriage to Seneca Falls to attend the first Women's Rights Convention in America. She saw the roads filled with others like herself, forming one long procession on the path to equality. It was fitting that my spring and summer of discovery should end on this historic ground. I had witnessed the fragile bloom of democracy taking root in China, Africa, Eastern Europe, and Latin America. The drive for freedom in those countries was the same drive that made America. The link between Harriet Tubman and Nelson Mandela was a part of the same human journey. I returned home with a renewed reverence for our flawed but vigorous system of government and new ideas about how to put it to work for all citizens. And when I thought about the obstacles Bill and I still faced in Washington, I dipped deep into the well of inspiration that Harriet Tubman had handed down to us all and vowed to just keep on going. August 1998 was a bloody month, and its events seemed to signal a turning point at the end of a hopeful decade. On August 7th, the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were simultaneously bombed by Islamic terrorists, injuring over 5,000 people and killing 264, among them 12 Americans. It was the most devastating of a series of attacks on American targets overseas, and an omen of things to come. Bill was more focused than ever on finding the causes of the terror campaign and isolating its leaders. It was increasingly evident to the intelligence community that a diabolical Saudi exile named Osama bin Laden was organizing and bankrolling much of the terrorism in the Muslim world, and his attacks were getting bigger and bolder. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein had again defied UN demands requiring that weapons inspectors be granted full access to his facilities without notice. But Bill and his national security team were having a hard time directing congressional attention and government resources to the growing threats at home and abroad. Perhaps that was because so much energy in the news media, Congress, and the FBI was directed to an investigation of the president's private life. In late July, I learned from David Kendall that Starr had negotiated an immunity deal with Monica Lewinsky. Starr was determined to subpoena the president to testify, and Bill had to decide whether or not to cooperate. I agreed that Bill had to testify, and I didn't think there was any reason to worry if he did. It was just another hurdle. David Kendall was briefing Bill and me regularly on developments in the Starr investigation, and I knew that the prosecution had requested a blood sample from the president without specifying its significance. David thought it was possible the Office of the Independent Counsel was bluffing, trying to spook Bill right before his testimony. Early Saturday morning, August 15th, Bill woke me up just as he had months before. This time, he didn't sit on the bed, but paced back and forth. He told me for the first time that the situation was much more serious than he had previously acknowledged. He now realized he would have to testify that there had been an inappropriate intimacy. He told me that what had happened between them had been brief and sporadic. He couldn't tell me 7 months ago, he said, because he was too ashamed to admit it, and he knew how angry and hurt I would be. I could hardly breathe.
Gulping for air,
I started crying and yelling at him. What do you mean? What are you saying? Why did you lie to me? I was furious and getting more so by the second. He just stood there saying over and over again, I'm sorry. I am so sorry. I was trying to protect you and Chelsea. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Up until now, I only thought that he'd been foolish for paying attention to the young woman, and I was convinced that he was being railroaded. I couldn't believe he would do anything to endanger our marriage and our family. I was dumbfounded, heartbroken, and outraged that I'd believed him at all. Then I realized that Bill and I had to tell Chelsea. When I told him he had to do this, his eyes filled with tears. He had betrayed the trust in our marriage, and we both knew it might be an irreparable breach. And we had to tell Chelsea that he had lied to her, too. These were terrible moments for all of us. I didn't know whether our marriage could, or should, survive such a stinging betrayal. But I knew I had to work through my feelings carefully, on my own timetable. I desperately needed someone to talk to. So I called a friend who was also a counselor and sought guidance. This was the most devastating, shocking, and hurtful experience of my entire life. I couldn't figure out what to do, but I knew I had to find a calm place in my heart and mind to sort out my feelings. Despite the emotional wreckage all around him, Bill had to prepare his testimony and work on a statement to make to the nation. As we struggled with this personal and public crisis, the world provided another reality check. In Omagh, Northern Ireland, a renegade Irish Republican gang detonated a car bomb in a crowded market, killing 28, wounding more than 200, and badly damaging the peace process that Bill had worked so long and hard to nurture with Irish leaders. As reports of the casualties came in that Saturday afternoon, I remembered the times I'd sat with women in all parts of Ireland to talk about the troubles and to look for a way to achieve peace and reconciliation. Now that's what I had to do in the midst of my own heart-rending troubles. Bill gave his four-hour testimony on Monday afternoon in the MAP room. Starr had agreed to withdraw the subpoena, and the voluntary session was videotaped and relayed on closed circuit to the grand jury chamber. When it was over, at 6:25 p.m., Bill emerged from the room composed but deeply angry. I could tell from his body language that he had been through an ordeal. David Kendall had alerted the TV networks that Bill would briefly address the nation at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Some of Bill's most trusted advisors gathered in the solarium to help him work on his statement. David Kendall was there, as was Chelsea, who was trying to make sense of what was happening. I stayed away at first. I didn't much want to help Bill compose his public statement on a matter that violated my sense of decency and privacy. Finally, though, out of habit, maybe curiosity, perhaps love, I went upstairs. When I walked into the room at about 8 p.m., someone quickly switched off the sound on the television set. They knew I couldn't stand to hear whatever was being said. When I asked how things were going, it was clear that Bill still hadn't decided what to say. He wanted people to know that he deeply regretted misleading his family, his friends, and his country. He also wanted them to know that he did not believe he had lied during the Jones deposition because the questions had been so clumsy. But that sounded like legalistic hair splitting. He had made a terrible mistake, then tried to keep it a secret, and he needed to apologize. At the same time, he didn't think that the President of the United States could afford to appear on television looking weak. As the hour for his statement approached, everyone was putting in his or her two cents, and this was not helping Bill. He wanted to use this opportunity to point out the unfairness and excesses of Starr's investigation, but there was a vigorous argument over whether he should take a shot at the independent counsel. Even though I was furious with him, I could see how upset he was, and it was awful to watch. So I finally said, "Well, Bill, this is your speech. You're the one who got yourself into this mess, and only you can decide what to say about it." Then Chelsea and I left the room. Eventually, everyone else left Bill alone, and he finished writing the statement by himself. Immediately after his statement, Bill was criticized for not apologizing enough, or rather for appearing less than sincere in his apology because he also criticized Starr. I was still too upset to have an opinion. Over the next days, reactions from most Americans indicated that they considered a consensual relationship between adults a private matter, and they did not believe that it affected a person's ability to do a good job. Bill's standing in public opinion polls remained high. His standing with me had hit rock bottom. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was go away on vacation, but I was desperate to get out of Washington. Chelsea wanted to go back to Martha's Vineyard, where good friends were waiting. So Bill, Chelsea, and I left for the island the following afternoon. Buddy, the dog, came along to keep Bill company. He was the only member of our family who was still willing to. Just before we left, Marcia Berry, my imperturbable press secretary, made a statement on my behalf. Clearly, she said, this is not the best day in Mrs. Clinton's life. This is a time when she relies on her strong religious faith. By the time we settled into our borrowed farmhouse, the adrenaline of the crisis had worn off, and I was left with nothing but profound sadness, disappointment, and unresolved anger. I could barely speak to Bill, and when I did, it was a tirade. I read, I walked on the beach. He slept downstairs, I slept upstairs. Days were easier than nights. Where do you turn when your best friend, the one who always helps you through hard times, is the one who wounded you? I felt unbearably lonely, and I could tell Bill did too. He kept trying to explain and apologize, but I wasn't ready to be in the same room with him, let alone forgive him. I would have to go deep inside myself and my faith to discover any remaining belief in our marriage, to find some path to understanding. At this point, I really didn't know what I was going to do. Shortly after we arrived, Bill returned briefly to the White House to oversee the cruise missile strikes against one of Osama bin Laden's trading camps in Afghanistan. In spite of clear evidence that bin Laden was responsible for the embassy bombings, Bill was criticized for ordering the attack. He was accused of doing it to divert attention from his own troubles and the growing talk of impeachment. Bill returned to a house thick with silence. Chelsea spent most of her time with our friends, Jill and Ken Iskell and their son Zach. They offered their home and hearts for my confused and hurting daughter. And then Walter Cronkite called and coaxed the three of us to come out on his boat for a sail. We didn't want to go at first, but Walter and his wife Betsy had a comforting attitude about the people who were calling for Bill's head and criticizing me for putting up with him. "This is just unbelievable," Walter said. "Why don't these people get a life? You know, I've lived long enough to know that good marriages go through tough times. None of us is perfect. Let's go sailing." We took him up on his offer. Although I was too numb at that point to say I relaxed, it was refreshing to be out on the open water, and the Cronkites' kind concern lifted my spirits. Maurice Templesman, who came to Martha's Vineyard every summer, was also wonderful to me. I had gotten to know him even better since Jackie's death, and he visited us in the White House. He called and asked if I would come by. We met on his yacht one evening and watched the lights of boats coming into the harbor at Menemsha. He talked for a while about Jackie, whom he missed terribly, and he told me he understood how hard her life had been at times. "I know that your husband really loves you," he said, "and I hope you can forgive him." Maurice didn't want to infringe on my privacy, and he offered his advice gently. I accepted it with gratitude. After we talked, it was an immense relief just to sit quietly by the water in the company of a good friend. I was thankful for the support and counsel I received during this time, particularly from Don Jones, my youth minister, who had become a lifelong friend. Don reminded me of a classic sermon by the theologian Paul Tillich, "You Are Accepted." Don had once read it to our youth group in Park Ridge. Its premise is how sin and grace exist through life in constant interplay. Neither is possible without the other. The mystery of grace is that you cannot look for it. Grace strikes us when we are in great pain and restlessness, Tillich wrote. It happens, or it does not happen. Grace happens. Until it did, my main job was to put one foot in front of the other and get through another day. By the end of August, there was détente, if not peace, in our household. Although I was heartbroken and disappointed with Bill, My long hours alone made me admit to myself that I loved him. What I still didn't know was whether our marriage could or should last. I hadn't decided whether to fight for my husband and my marriage, but I was resolved to fight for my president. I had to get a grip on my feelings and focus on what I needed to do for myself. Fulfilling my personal and public obligations drew on a reservoir of different emotions, requiring different thinking and different judgments. For over 20 years, Bill had been my husband, my best friend, my partner in all of life's trials and joys. He was a loving father to our daughter. Now, for reasons he will have to explain, he had violated my trust, hurt me deeply, and given his enemies something real to exploit after years of enduring their false charges, partisan investigations, and lawsuits. My personal feelings and political beliefs were on a collision course. As his wife, I wanted to wring Bill's neck. But he was not only my husband, he was also my president. And I thought that, in spite of everything, Bill led America and the world in a way that I continued to support. No matter what he had done, I did not think any person deserved the abusive treatment he had received. His privacy, my privacy, Monica Lewinsky's privacy, and the privacy of our families had been invaded in a cruel and gratuitous manner. I believed what my husband did was morally wrong. I also knew his failing was not a betrayal of his country. Everything I had learned from the Watergate investigation convinced me that there were no grounds to impeach Bill. If men like Starr and his allies could ignore the Constitution and abuse power for ideological and malicious ends to topple a president, I feared for my country. Bill's presidency, the institutional presidency, and the integrity of the Constitution hung in the balance. I knew what I did and said in the next days and weeks would influence not just Bill's future and mine, but also America's. As for my marriage, it hung in the balance too, and I wasn't at all sure which way the scale would or should tip. Life moved on, and I moved with it. I accompanied Bill to Moscow for another state visit on September 1st, and then on to Ireland to meet Tony and Cherie Blair and to walk the streets of Omagh, where the bombing occurred. The huge contingent of reporters who followed the president to Russia and Ireland was looking for more than a peace mission story. They were watching both of us closely for clues to the state of our marriage. Did we stand close together or apart? Was I frowning or crying behind dark glasses? And what was the significance of the knitted sweater I bought for Bill in Dublin, which he wore to Limerick for his first golf game in more than a month? I desperately wanted to restore a zone of privacy for myself and my family, but I wondered if that would ever be possible again. By the time we returned to the White House, there were several challenges on my mind, personal and political. Bill and I had agreed to participate in regular marital counseling to determine whether or not we were going to salvage our marriage. On one level, I was emotionally shell-shocked and trying to deal with the raw wound I had suffered. On another level, I believed Bill was a good person and a great president. I viewed the independent counsel's assault on the presidency as an ever-escalating political war, and I was on Bill's side. When people ask me how I kept going during such a wrenching time, I tell them that there is nothing remarkable about getting up and going to work every day, even when there is a family crisis at home. Every one of us has had to do it at some time in our lives, and the skills required to cope are the same for a first lady or a forklift operator. I just had to do it all in the public eye. Even if I was undecided about my personal future, I was absolutely convinced that Bill's private behavior and his misguided effort to conceal it did not constitute a legal or historical basis for impeachment under the Constitution. I believed he ought to be held accountable for his behavior by me and by Chelsea, not by a misuse of the impeachment process. But I also knew that the opposition could use the press to create an atmosphere in which political pressure would grow for impeachment or resignation, regardless of the law. In early September, David Kendall discovered that the Office of the Independent Counsel was ready to send a referral on impeachment to the House Judiciary Committee, which would then decide whether the matter should go to the full House of Representatives for a